That Triathlon Show 393. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Michele Zanini. Michele is a PhD candidate at the University of Loughborough, who is studying the connection between running economy, durability, and strength training. And he's also a physiologist and strength and conditioning coach with the Italian Triathlon Federation. And a third arrow in his quiver is working alongside the legendary running coach Renato Canova. We ended up talking for 2 hours, so I decided to split this interview into two parts. So today is part one, and next week we'll hear part two. And in part one here today, we'll hear about Michele's work with the Italian Triathlon Federation. We will discuss the science of running economy and durability. And then next week, we discuss strength training for endurance performance and Michele's work with Renato Canova, as well as Canova's training principles. Before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Form. The Form smart swim goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training right on the goggle lens, including splits, a pace, stroke rate, and heart rate. This means that you can execute your swim workouts better, whether it's pushing harder when you're starting to fall off the pace or holding back when you're accidentally going faster than you should. It also means that if you're using a Garmin watch in the pool, you can finally get rid of that, because the goggles will automatically start and stop each interval when you push off from the wall or reach the wall at the end, and they will give you accurate splits based on that. Personally, I also think that it makes swimming more fun and motivating when you have some feedback within the intervals, not just between intervals. And it does make me want to go to the pool more often, as I have the accountability of the goggles throughout the entire workout. You can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. And thank you to Senate. The Senate indoor swim trainer allows you to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency, even if you're short on time. It is a great tool for busy athletes because you can do a quality Senate workout in just 15 minutes at home, even on days when you don't have time to get to the pool. It is a perfect complement to pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to focus specifically on key aspects of your swimming, like your catch and your power, and you can isolate them more easily than you can in the water. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back, and you can get 20% off your first order on senatesuinter.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's part one of my interview with Michele Zanini. Welcome to the Triathlon Show, Michele. How are you doing?
Oh, good. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. And how are you, Michael?
I'm very good. Thank you. So tell us a bit more about yourself. Who are you for the listeners that haven't heard about you before?
Yeah, no, thanks for inviting me over, first of all. I've been a hungry follower of your podcast in the past few years. So really glad to be invited, and wanted to commend on your effort that the effort you put over the last few years on this. But yeah, I'm a physiologist, and I'm finishing off a PhD in exercise physiology at Loughborough University. Alongside, I work with professional athletes, both in running and triathlon, and I work primarily as SNC coach and physiologist for them, together with my job with the Italian Triathlon Federation at the moment.
So can you explain that in a bit more detail? So you work with the Italian Triathlon Federation, and that's with the triathletes, obviously, but when you mentioned working with runners, what is the setting of that work?
Yeah, so I've been working with runners from probably 7-8 years now, and I've had the chance to go to Kenya a couple of times with two different coaches, and then started developing some connection with Renato Canova. And I had the chance to be close to him for a few years now. And yeah, been supporting part of the SNC for his group, as well as just applying the knowledge from Renato to less professional athletes, or let's say recreational runners or non-professional runners, really, and then moved to triathlon from there.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool opportunity, and we'll discuss more about that in a little bit. But then one other follow-up on your introduction is your PhD that you're finalizing. What is the topic of that PhD?
Yeah, we're basically looking into the relationship between running economy, durability or fatigue development or fatigue resistance, I think we still have to find the precise word to describe that, but basically how physiology changes as we fatigue and how that affects performance, and linking up with strength training and how that can be helpful to prevent fatigue development. And I work with Rich Blagrove, which has been probably among the most influential people in the area, as well as Jonathan Follan, which is very much into neuromuscular performance and running economy itself.
Yeah, and Rich Blagrove has been a guest on the podcast before, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. What I want to talk about first, I guess, is just the role that, as you described, being a physiologist and strength and conditioning coach within a high-performance setting like the Italian Triathlon Federation. So can you talk in a bit more detail about what that role entails?
Yeah, I think when we look into the applied side of physiology for supporting athletes, when we get the scientific lens, the research lens, we always think about lab testing and how to optimize that. When you work with athletes, you have a very big part of it, which is related to the race demands and the training measurements and feedback, basically. So I would say the three roles that we try to achieve, or the three outcomes we try to support with the Federation at the moment, is racing analysis, and therefore trying to work out the demands that the specific race has and how the individuals we're working with, they can bridge the gap between their performance or their physiology at the moment to the race demands. Then supporting training prescription via physiological testing. So we may get some threshold assessments and make sure that they're training at the right intensity, or if they need extra work in an area, then we can try to give some support on that. And then try to support training methodology and racing strategy via evidence-based support, which can then basically be implemented by the coach based on their individual needs. So we can say, well, actually, you may want to add this type of workout with this given athlete because you're missing an anaerobic capacity sort of outcome, for example. So to give an example, just recently we've got a test from an athlete which is racing in World Triathlon Series, and he's been lacking a little bit the specificity on the run. So he would get a very good swim and very good bike, but then when he comes to the run, he still has to develop that pace that is required for the races. And when you look back at his training logs, you could see there was a lack of that specific intensity. So running, I think in World Triathlon Series at the moment, where if you want to be top 10, you have to run around 255 to 302, 305, probably three flat 302. And yeah, if you're training very far away from there, you won't be able to achieve that in a race, mainly when you got a run off bike. So the target to develop over the last few months has been, well, try to get some consistent exercise in that area, basically around the second threshold or just above the second threshold, which wasn't happening before.
Mm. And just out of curiosity, because there could be one or two possibilities here that I see. I mean, one of them is that, well, this athlete never trained that he was always training quite a bit below that speed. But then the other could be that I've also seen and heard about is that athletes go and do a bunch of really fast 400s on the track, 240 pace, 245 pace, but then in the race they can only run at 310, 315 pace. So they are just training way above what they are actually capable of doing in racing. And somebody like Joel Filial has been some very kind of, I guess, outspoken almost about how you have to earn the right to train at certain paces, basically racing, training closer to your race pace, and there's no need to go above that. But of course, there's a push and pull there, I guess. But what was the example with this athlete? Was he always training, or was he never training fast enough, or was it that he was just training too far above that race pace and not reaching that specificity?
Yeah, as you said, you probably need a little bit of speed support. So this particular athlete was doing it. If anything, when we tested him, his speed at VO2 max was pretty good. And the first threshold was also good. But the gap between VO2 max and the second threshold was a little bit too much. And we look back at the training logs and the type of workouts he's been doing recently. And you could clearly see that that target wasn't happening, that intensity in training wasn't happening. And I think that's bridging two of the all the three errors I've mentioned, actually. So we got a physiological test for which we could have an idea about what the athlete is lacking. We've got the race demands. So, well, you know that to race at this level, you need to run at this pace. And then we've got the training log analysis for which we've realized, well, you're actually not doing as much specific work in that realm as you need to. And probably we got the chance to speak about it later, but I believe you have a funnel of intensities that you need to work towards. So you got like your specific race demands, and but in running it's very easy because you just have race pace. In other sports is different. In triathlon, you have the tactics, you have the ability to run, to stay on the bike and stay with the group and be able to produce maximal efforts continuously over the race. But to keep it simple for the run now, you have that specific speed that you want to target for the race, and you can support it from both the endurance and the speed end, and funnel through from something which is maybe 10% or 15% faster and slower, and then go towards the target speed as the training progresses.
So this runner was doing both of that on the sides, but he was not really hitting those specific paces when you looked at his training log.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, got it.
Well, if he was hitting it, it would have been maybe just too little. So maybe you would get it for 2-3 kilometers in a workout of 10, and that probably is not enough, because if you have to run an Olympic distance, that's going to be 10 kilometers at that pace. So if you train just 2 or 3, that may not be specific enough in some part of the season.
Yeah. When you mentioned analyzing race demands, this is something that I think is really interesting in short course triathlon, because obviously we know the, as you say, the paces on the run that are required and the speeds on the bike. And I guess most athletes do use a bike computer and power meter. So the bike is a bit quite easy to analyze. On the swim side, we know, again, the splits. But the one thing, I guess, with the swim and the run, most athletes, nobody uses a watch on the swim, and only very few athletes does it on the run. So first of all, you have to, I guess, trust that the distance is measured accurately, and there is in World Triathlon, of course, they have a 10% margin of error for the run. So the run could be between 9.6 to 10.4 kilometers, and that would be okay. How do you analyze the race demands, or even how a race went from that perspective, when compared to long course triathlon, I think you have a lot less data to actually work with?
Yeah, so first of all, I want to make clear that that's not only my work. It's a team of 4 of us. And there's one person that just takes care of the data analysis. So it's really a team effort all the way through. And I think that gives us a lot of value to each other and to the team and to the athletes, because I've got my ideas and somebody else might have slightly different ideas. And when we get together, when we get them together, it just makes it better, to be honest. And yeah, I want to commend his work because he's been super insightful in the last year and a half with the support of the team. But basically, from the running perspective, we've got Stride footpods at the moment. We just feed it to the athlete, or we try to feed it to the athlete when they're about to race. And then we just keep the record of that. And we got well, all the biomechanics data that can be given from the pod. And it's very accurate on the speed as well. So we tested it in the lab against the treadmill and on the track as well. And as long as you calibrate it for the right shoe, so it has some errors based on the type of shoe you use. But as long as you calibrate it beforehand, it is very accurate. And you can actually see the pacing of the athlete as well, because you get splits from the races, but they vary. They may be 8 splits, they may be 4 splits, and you don't really get to see the final kick or the initial burst after the bike. While with the foot pod, you can actually see the full profile of the athlete and see how the behavior changes during the race or due to some events happening within the run. So we've been trying to push coaches to implement that in training as well, just to have a comparison between training and racing, and yeah, that he's been quite helpful with just pacing and racing strategies for the run part of the race.
That's really cool. Really, really nice way of doing it, because the stride can record in its internal memory, I guess, without needing to have that watch to transmit to, or even a phone. Obviously, you don't want to run with a phone in a race like that. So, that's a smart way of doing it. When you talk about the physiological testing and how that can inform training prescription, are there any other than the example you already mentioned, are there any other examples that you could point to just to get a bit of a broader idea of how this is used in a high performance setting, the testing, and how it then relates to the training prescription?
Yeah, so when we look into the testing for these type of athletes, one thing that we want to consider is the time that you have available. So it gets very hard to get full protocols that may be optimal, maybe very accurate, but they may require 2, 3, or maybe half a day of testing sometimes. So you really don't have that time with athletes, and mainly with triathletes, that they train anything between 25 and 35 hours per week. So you really need to get the test done quickly and try to get as many data as possible. So you may have to compromise a bit the quality of the test and try to get the most important outcomes. So sometimes we prioritize the bike, sometimes we get bike and running. It depends which part of the season we are in as well. So at the beginning of the season this year, for example, we just focused on the bike because they needed to build up a lot of kilometers on the bike, and we wanted to make sure that they were riding at the right intensity. But after the winter period, you want to have an idea of the baseline post general preparation ahead of the races, so you might want to test both. We've got some swimming testing as well, but of course that's a bit more complicated because you don't really have the chance to measure as many variables as you would get from running and cycling. As for the testing itself, we just try to run the test within 45 minutes to an hour, and the bike is a ramp test, whether with the run we tend to use a step test with lactate measurements, because that is probably a bit more reliable with running. A ramp test with running, due to the ventilation, which is slightly different on running. I find it a bit more difficult to interpret. So you can get VT1 and VT2, but I found a bit more difficult than using lactate threshold 1 and 2 for training, not really training prescription, just to get an idea about where the two thresholds stand and how far they are from VO2 max and from each other.
And why do you prefer the ramp test on the bike compared to the step test? Do you prefer the ventilatory thresholds because it is, you can get them more reliably on the bike compared to the lactate thresholds?
Probably just because it's quicker. So there's another physiologist that takes care mainly of the bike. So again, it's a teamwork. I take part of the strength and conditioning and the running side, and he takes care primarily of the cycling side. But we work together, and it's really a push and pull of compromises. But yeah, even in research, I think the RAMP test works quite well and is quite reliable. Whether with running, you may get a bit more noise just due to the running, which is by basically making bounce the wire as you're going along. So you may get a bit more issues. And even just like ventilation wise, you have a bit more variability on the run than on the bike.
Mm. And do you have any interest in the other physiological parameters than the thresholds, whether they be ventilatory or lactate? For example, on the bike, you measure VO2 max, I'm sure, but is that an interesting parameter that you actually, or actionable parameter, let's say, that you identify certain athletes might be lacking there, or certain athletes are more than well-equipped enough in terms of VO2 max? And are there other parameters that you're also looking at in terms of the physiological markers?
Yeah, I mean, probably the full profile of VO2 max thresholds and economy or the cost of exercise, either in running or cycling, gives you the three determinants of performance from Joyner model. And you can have an idea based on the database we've got on how the athletes are sitting within the ranges that we would expect. So powered VO2 max or speed of VO2 max, we have now a decent idea about where they should sit for this type of athletes and maybe for junior athletes or under 23 athletes as well. So that gives you an idea about the development of the athlete longitudinally as well. And having the VO2 max sort of as a ceiling, you can look into LT1 and LT2 or VT1, VT2, but basically the two thresholds between moderate and heavy and heavy and severe domain to grasp an idea about how close they are to the ceiling. If you have an athlete which has got LT1 of 95% VO2 max, you know that that's going to be very hard to push up unless you raise the ceiling. So you do maybe a little bit of work on VO2 max speed to try to raise that. On the other hand, we also test fat max for cycling. We're looking into maybe considering doing it for running, but my belief is that the speed is going to be too low for it to be trained. We will looking into it, but yeah, at the moment we're not really estimating it. And then we look into some maximal efforts on the bike for power production and maximal power there. Finally, we've got some testing from a strength perspective and reactivity perspective. So drop jumps and isometric mid-thigh pull at the moment that we're trying to implement at training camps when the athletes, they come all together and we can test them back to back, one after the other.
And you've talked about how this is a teamwork and a team effort. As a physiologist and the other physiologists work with the coaches, is there a lot of push and pull there between the coaches have their ideas and the physiologists have their ideas, or are you generally on the same page? How does that work in general?
Yeah, it really depends on the person. So one thing that I personally try to focus initially is just to get to know the coach and the athletes and try to understand their way of walking and even just like the way of communicating, really, because communication to me is key. You see day in, day out in any environment, you can be very knowledgeable, but if you can't communicate appropriately, you really lack opportunities. You really struggle creating an impact. So first of all, you want to make sure that your input can be taken in a positive way from the coach, and then from there you can start giving inputs. So it's initially just try to create the trust between what you're doing and what you can provide to the coach, and then just try to suggest implementation of optimization of training or racing, or maybe just make a comment about, well, this race went this way, this may be the reason. So initially, it is tough when you get into the new environment because, well, nobody really knows who you are and what you can give to them. So I think a lot of people try to just prove themselves as they start off, whether, it's probably best to try to provide value as you go along. So there's no need to step into the environment and say, I can do this. It's more like, well, let's see, what can I provide? Just looking at your work and how you're doing things at the moment. And from there, I'll try to give some insights about it. So one example I can give about this is not related to physiology, it's related to strength training, but it is quite clear. So when I've started supporting some of the athletes from a methodological strength and conditioning perspective, I just stepped in the gym and looked into the program of the athletes and followed them through the training, having conversations with the coaches before and after training. And eventually coaches just started asking my opinion and tried to implement some of the suggestions. And then from there, we started working together. And now I'm ending up supporting more than half of the national team directly, and then just overseeing the methodology of other coaches as well. So, yeah, I think it would have been very different if I would have just stepped in and said, well, you're doing this suboptimally. We can optimize it in this way. It's really getting to know the environment you're in, first of all, and then try to give insights about what can be changed or optimized.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Thank you for that. Is there anything else that you want to mention or talk about in regard to working in a high-performance setting as a physiologist and strength and conditioning coach before we move on to the next topic, or do you think we covered most of it?
Yeah, no, I think we covered most of it. Again, very important to just have a efficient, effective communication and just having a teamwork, so having a two-way communication, of course, within the sports science team and then between the sports science team and the coaches. I think we don't get as much pressure as the coaches get because the results, they are dependent on our work, but not as much as the coaches. So you want to be aware of that when you may want to try to implement something new and the coach goes, well, I don't know if I want to do it, or they say, well, not now. So yeah, even just giving well-timed suggestions, it is probably important. And of course, coaches are more interested in trying something new when they're far away from the main season or when some positive results are happening. So yeah, that may be something that you want to consider strategically when you want to try to make an impact.
Makes a lot of sense. Yep. So moving on a bit to the topics you mentioned that you're working on as part of your PhD. So strength and conditioning, running economy and durability. We'll discuss all of these topics a bit and how they relate. So maybe we start with running economy. How important is that for running performance? And are there differences between different events if we compare, for example, the marathon with the mid-distance events, for example?
Yeah, of course. So running economy, as we mentioned before, it can be considered one of the three parameters for determining endurance performance or running performance. You get VO2 max, you get thresholds or fraction of utilization of VO2 max at a specific pace, which can be the marathon or can be a 10K or whatever it is. And then you've got running economy. So that's basically the cost of the exercise you're performing. And well, you can use either energy cost or oxygen cost. There's a lot of debate at the moment between the two and which one is better. I think at the moment we can just use both and emphasize either of them depending on the focus we have and what we want to inform. As for how does it change as determinant of performance as the length of the run changes, so the event, moving from, let's say, 800 meters all the way to the marathon, it gains more influence as the race lengthens, because basically you just, running economy being the cost of running, the more economical you are, the more energy you're going to have towards the end of long-lasting races. So it's not as important in 800, 1500 meters, where you got a lot of anaerobic contribution as well, where the more you lengthen it, the farther it goes from the farther the intensity goes from VO2 max as well. So the VO2 max may get a little bit less important. And on the other hand, running economy gets more important because it's basically giving you an idea about how much your glycogen is depleting, for example, how much your storages are depleting as you exercise. And that capacity, it may eventually limit your outcome. One other important thing to mention about that is that with high profile athletes, elite athletes, I think it's a paper from the 1980s, 1990, they pointed out that running economy, it's more, it can be more correlated to performance than VO2 max. So basically, when you're an elite, your VO2 max is going to be very similar across the board, but running economy, it will vary, and the athlete that is more economical, it may be able to perform better. And of course, running economy influences both the speed at VO2 max and some maximal speeds. Because if you've got an athlete that has a, let's say, 70 millimoles, for milliliters per kilo VO2 max, you're using more oxygen at the same speed, then you're not going to be as quick at the speed of VO2 max, and likewise for some maximal speeds. It's much more easy to describe via graphic, but that's one of the limitations of podcasts. And it is probably one of the capabilities that can be improved with training more than VO2 max. So if you look at longitudinal data from Paula Radcliffe from Andy Jones' paper in 2006, you can see that from where she was, I think, under 20, all the way when she set the world record in 2003, she kept her VO2 max fairly stable, but her running economy got better and better and improved by roughly 15%. And of course, alongside, performance went up and speed of VO2 max got faster and faster as well.
Yeah, that's a good summary. And one thing just to mention as well for the listeners, when you say that running economy is one of the determinants of endurance performance along with VO2 max and fractional utilization, then basically what that means is that you can essentially, if you know all of those three parameters, you can predict a performance, which was done, I think, with Paula Radcliffe as well. Andy Jones did that, maybe not in a paper, but at least I remember him saying that he did that very closely for several of her marathons. So knowing her VO2 max and her running economy and her fractional utilization, he could say that you're going to run a 2:16:30 or whatever it was for any given marathon. And of course, it's not necessarily going to be 100% correct, but you're going to get pretty close if you know those three parameters, and that's why they are the determinants of performance. So you have described how running economy is very important. It can be improved. It can be improved longitudinally, maybe more so than VO2 max. What are the factors then that influence running economy?
Yeah, you got a fair few, and I don't think we know all of them yet. We've got, of course, fiber type. So type 1 fiber, they tend to be more economical, more efficient, because they have a higher mitochondrial density and mitochondrial efficiency. So that's another parameter. You get substrate availability and utilization. So if you're able to use a higher percentage of carbohydrates or fat, that may influence economy. So basically, as the respiratory exchange ratio drops, and therefore the fat utilization goes up, your efficiency, well, not efficiency really, your economy gets worse because you're using about 10-12% more oxygen to use fats than carbohydrates. So that's one thing to keep in mind when you're looking into maybe analyzing some data from long-lasting efforts or long-lasting trials. ARIA generally tends to drop, and that increases fat utilization and therefore increases oxygen utilization due to that. So that is linked to the fact that, well, we want to keep the carbohydrate utilization high, and therefore we feed carbohydrates during exercise, because otherwise, if we lean towards fat, they're not as efficient. In fact, world-class marathon runners, they tend to run the marathon with respiratory exchange ratio about one, and therefore primarily on carbohydrates. You've got oxygen availability and delivery, so basically the capacity to continuously deliver oxygen and therefore capillarization as well to the muscle. And well, that links up to altitude as well. So you may get different economy in altitude than at sea level. And well, it's probably linked more generally to VO2 max as well. So you get need to enhance the oxygen delivery to the muscle, and therefore you create more red blood cells, and that eventually lifts up your VO2 max due to peripheral adaptations. From instead a biomechanical and neuromuscular perspective, one of the key things that probably differs between running and cycling or other activities that they don't have a stretch shortening cycle is the stiffness of the elastic structures in the leg, primarily in the Achilles tendon. That basically allows you to storage some of the energy that is coming from the landing of the step, and then use that to propel forward. It is very difficult to estimate. So when you look into some modeling related to the contribution of the energy production from the stiffness of these structures, or just like from elastic energy saved via the running gait, it really ranges from, I believe it's 40 to 60%. Don't quote me on that, but there's a review paper about it, and you literally see the estimations going all over the place. So I think we still struggle with really quantifying that, just because it's, we, at the moment, we can't really quantify mechanical work in running, and you can have metabolic work, but if you don't have mechanical work, then you can't estimate the efficiency of running, which is basically giving you the capacity of these structures to produce work. Within the muscle, you have an efficiency which is up to 25%, but again, due to these structures, it seems with running, it can go up to 40, 45, 50%, or perhaps even more with sprinting. So basically, the more stiff your structure, tendons and elastic structures are, the less energy you need to propel forward. And of course, on the other hand, you may risk to get injured if the stiffness is too high. So that's also to keep in mind. And then we've got muscle activation. It is quite difficult to measure because you've got EMG, which is usually on surface, and at the moment is not accurate enough to give you a specific insight unless you measure it multiple times. But it seems, for example, strength training can help with reducing the co-contractions and basically enhancing intra and intermuscular efficiency of the muscles. So that would reduce the cost of exercise because you're using less muscle fibers for that given effort. And then when we look into the other biomechanical parameters, you also have ground contact time. So the lower the contact time, the more springy you are. So the more elastic you can be, and you can use that potential energy from the step to propel forward. For that vertical oscillations, and that's basically telling you where is the direction of your push. So of course, as you run, you can't go only forward. You go up and forward, but the more vertical oscillation is gonna increase the cost because you're pushing perhaps a bit too high. So with middle distance runners, you can clearly see that on a treadmill, they tend to bounce much more than the marathon runners, where marathon runners, they tend to be much more flat. So vertical oscillation there will be quite different, and that is going to have an influence on the cost of exercise. And then, recently footwear, they've been a game changer for running and even triathlon. So I don't think it's going to be part of the discussion today, but certainly something that allows you to save energy due to mechanical changes and mechanical enhancement of efficiency.
And what are some training interventions or training strategies, training factors that allows a runner to improve their running economy, whether it's in the short term or in the long term over years and years?
Yeah, there's a good review from Barnes 2015 about it. And basically, when they reviewed the studies related to that, they found that high-intensity training can improve running economy acutely. You've got altitude training that can help from what we said before, basically having more hemoglobin mass delivering oxygen to the muscles. You've got strength training, and we may want to get in some details about it later if you've got the time. But basically, via strength training, you may alter that stiffness that we mentioned before, as well as potentially just enhancing the coordination within and between muscles, and therefore reducing the utilization of the fibers. And then one other way for which strength training may create these adaptations and improve economy is basically you increase the strength seeding of the single fiber, basically the maximum strength of the single fiber, and therefore to produce the same effort, the same stride length, you may be able to use less fibers because the strength of every given one of them is higher now. So if your ceiling is 100 and you bring it up to 120, let's say you're using 30% of your fiber at 100, when that goes up to 120, you may use 25. So that helps activating less muscle fibers. It helps having a bit more capillary delivery of oxygen via the capillary, because when fibers are contracting, there's very little oxygen delivery happening to the fiber because it needs to be relaxed. And finally, that will help reducing the cost of running. And as for other interventions, Andy Shaw, I think he published a paper in 2017. He's the physiologist of British Athletics, and he tried to do downhill running as a strategy to improve running economy. I don't think they found any effect, but research is always tricky from this perspective, because you get underpowered studies, so you may get 12, 13 people, and you don't have a difference there, maybe just because there's not enough people to be involved in to get tested in the study. So that may be a strategy, even though, again, there's no evidence of it. And I think, again, Kyle Barnes, for his PhD, he did uphill running intervention, and he may have found some effect there, but don't quote me on that, because I think the sample size was very, very low. I think they got 5 different type of uphill running exercises, and they found some effect for some of the training sessions, but the sample size was very little, literally less than 6 people per type of training. So again, very difficult to give any insights on these numbers.
Got it. Yep. And what about durability? Can you define durability? And then we can move on to discuss the how durability and economy might be connected.
Yeah, so durability, it can be possibly defined as the fourth factor of endurance performance, or, well, that's what some authors they've been pointing out recently, and I think the first one doing it has been Andrew Jones, firstly in his paper with the analysis of Eliud Kipchoge and other people involved with the Breaking 2 study, and then Stephen Saylor and Ed Maunder as well in a review paper back in 2021. But yeah, basically it's the ability of the athletes to maintain their physiology or the biomechanics efficiency or any of the parameters that we can measure that they can influence performance consistently over time. So there's a lot of there are a few papers now out about cycling and how the power duration relationship changes as we fatigue, and how high profile athletes, so world tour cyclists, they can maintain high power outputs even after a given amount of work compared to junior athletes or under 23 athletes. So yeah, it basically just tells you, well, are you able to maintain your ability to produce efforts in a fresh state all the way till the end of a race, or all the way to after a given amount of work you've produced, or any type of interval efforts you may do. So there's some research happening at the moment also about interval training and how that may affect parameters such as the power duration curve or other variables that can be measured.
Mm. So clearly, for most athletes, and the best athletes maybe have the least decrement in performance, but there is that decrement in performance if you go out and do a solid ride for 3 hours, and then you try to do a hard 20-minute effort at the beginning and the end. You're probably going to be, most listeners here are going to not do as good in the one at the end of a hard 3-hour ride, and that's what a lot of the world tour cycling is about, being at your strongest at the end of the stage. But there's also the question of what are the physiological parameters that are maybe changing underneath that performance change. So how much do we know about that in general? And then maybe we can discuss how running economy is a part of that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's a lot of interest at the moment. There's quite some field data, but there's limited evidence of what are the physiological changes happening. You do get a lot of studies related to fatigue and how that influences or how the development of parameters changes due to fatigue. But one thing that is probably very important from an applied perspective is the specificity of the task. So as you mentioned, you get with two cyclists that they perform a given amount of power for 2 or 3 hours, and then they still be able to maintain high powers then. So that's the performance for their events with running and, let's say, the marathon. You basically just want to be able to maintain that pace without having a cardiac drift or having changes in your biomechanics and so on. In triathlon, it differs even more because you got the ability to basically cope with the high intensity efforts of the bike, speaking about short distance and Olympic distance, so sprint and Olympic. You got fast swim that has to allow you to be in the pack for the ride, and then you got the bike, which is usually quite intense and with high intensity efforts, and then you've got the run, which is sort of even paced, but it depends where you're sitting in the race in that moment. So the demand and the performance changes, the determinants of performance changes and physiological changes that happen in the bike off the run or even just on the bike itself from the triathlon is going to be completely different than the demands and the changes of physiology that are happening on the World Tour cycling team. So if you want to try to look into what is changing physiologically and how that can inform performance, you probably need to be quite specific with your sort of fatiguing protocols. But yeah, in general, from what we've seen, critical power drops. VT1 also seems to drop. There's a study from Ed Munder and Stevenson 2022 about this, and they found that with I think recreationally trained athletes, VT1 dropped from a fresh state after 2.5 hours of cycling around VT1. You've got changes in cycling efficiency or running economy, and we can get in the details of that later, but basically it seems that you got an increase in oxygen cost that leads up to an increase of basically your fraction of utilization of VO2max. And then as for VO2max, well, we've got data from our lab that are not published yet, but it seems that VO2max also changes and it seems to drop, whether that is VO2max or is VO2peak, so the ability just to produce high-intensity efforts, but that may not be a real VO2max physiologically. It's a different thing. But yeah, it seems like your ceiling is also dropping. So basically, to keep it simple on running, for example, you have an increase in oxygen cost and a decrease in VO2max. So your fraction of utilization, if at the beginning is 80%, after 2 hours, it may be 85, 87% VO2max. And that will have an influence of everything else in the race. Same for biomechanics-related parameters or fatigue-related parameters from a neuromuscular perspective. So central and peripheral fatigue, they're going to change. Dehydration, so you'll have most likely dehydration occurring during the exercise. And if you're getting dehydrated above 2 to 3%, you may incur in reduced performance because of the literature that is available on that. And basically, just like reduced ability of your biological processes to be optimal. You've got increasing cold temperature. So again, when you're exercising in the heat, you're not going to perform as well as exercising in a fresh condition. And well, that's basically, I wouldn't say similar, but as your cold temperature goes up, your metabolism just slightly changes and your homeostasis is not going to be as optimal anymore. So these are just like a few parameters that we can measure that they change during exercise. How do these link to performance? It will vary depending on the event and how specific you want to be with that. Another thing, it can well be maximum sprinting speed. So I don't think there's any study out there measuring the changes in maximum sprinting speed pre-post continuous running. There are a few from Ivaskola in Finland, and there again, they found a drop between 15 and 20%, I believe, or let's say 10 to 15, just to be on the safe side. So your ability to produce maximal efforts also reduces, and W prime, D prime, they may be reduced as well due to that. So that's the anaerobic capacity that you can have above critical power, basically.
So there's basically most factors seem to be affected naturally, as we would expect, I guess. And I think a key point that you made was about the specificity, that if you want to assess how, whether it's physiological markers or just the performance itself, how it's affected, then being specific about the protocol. I remember when talking with I actually can't remember if it was Adil Tveiten or Olav Alexander Bu who talked about it, but when the Norwegians had been doing quite a lot of specific testing in the Tokyo build-up with just doing a 1,500-meter hard or all-out swim and a 40K bike or one-hour bike, and and doing tests, doing running tests in a fatigue state, or doing biking tests after that 1500 meter hard swim, and so on. So just testing really specifically. So that's an excellent point. But that would obviously be different for a marathoner or a world tour cyclist. They would design the protocol specifically for those activities. Is this something that you have tested within the Italian Federation, doing tests in a fatigue state?
We're considering it. It's not happening at the moment. Again, it's very difficult logistically, but I think it may be valuable. I think we're at the point where we can have an idea about the parameters that we want to measure, and that they may change more than others due to fatigue development, mainly from the bike. But yeah, at the moment we didn't test any of these parameters yet. We're on our way to convince some of the athletes or coaches to do it, but didn't do it yet. I think the Danish team are doing something related to that with half Ironman and Ironman distances, can't think of anybody else that is testing it at the moment, at least from the triathlon world. Again, it's very difficult for athletes as well, and that's one of the conversations that I had with Andy Shaw and Andy Jones as well. How can we test this capacity without affecting the training of the athletes? Because with this level of athletes, you really need to push them towards the limit to get some changes that are significant, and they're not only noise from the measures. So if they're within the error measurement, then you're just not sure if this is changing or not. And if you want to get outside that uncertainty, well, with this level of athletes, you need to push them very hard. And then if you push them very hard, then they may take 2 or 3 days to recover. And most of the time, they don't have 2 or 3 days to recover. So that's one point from the athlete and the program. And the other one from us as a support team, you just don't have enough time in the day to do it, because you would have probably 2.5 hours or maybe 3 hours of testing for one single athlete. And then you have to repeat it over 7 or 8. Well, it really depends on how many you want to test. So with the Norwegian team, maybe Olaf had just Gustav and Blumenfeld. So that may be a bit more suitable. But if you have a big group and with big, I believe, if you speak about 6 or 7, it's already big for this type of testing. It really requires you a lot of work. Plus, you may want to test the fresh condition first. So you may want to test, I don't know, economy or VO2max or whatever, or critical speed, power, in a fresh state and then in a fatigue state. So you would have to have 2 tests within maybe 10, 15 days max. And that adds up a lot of layers of complications from a logistical perspective, as well as time constraints perspective.
Yeah, and not just the recovery before the test, but even if you are going to do a fresh state VO2 max test, you don't want to do it the day after you've been training for 6 hours with a lot of quality, right? Because that you need, maybe you don't need to taper fully for it, but at least you don't want to be fatigued for it, so you have to adjust the training before it a little bit, don't you think?
Yeah, that can be standardized, I think. So you, because triathletes, they are consistently training in a semi-fatigued state just because of the volumes they have. So as long as you standardize that, I don't think you'll have a big influence of it. As we said at the beginning, you have to compromise something. So if you want to test, let's say, VO2max fresh and then a VO2max in a fatigue state, then you may just maintain similar workouts or training sessions, let's say, the 2 days before, and then trial it. But yeah, at the moment, I don't think it's feasible. Unless you do it maybe off-season. But then if you do it off-season, you're measuring something else, because you don't have that amount of work accumulated that is going to lead up to the races. And as we said before, as you want to be specific, if you test that capacity 6 months, well, in triathlon, 6 months up, it doesn't happen, but and running in May. Let's say 2 months off a race and then 2 weeks off a race, the physiology is going to be quite different from the athlete. So it is quite complicated. One thing that may be helpful is maybe measuring like training data and looking to like long rides or run off bike from training data and see how these they change over time. Maybe changes in heart rate due to or changes in the ratio between heart rate and pace changes. So if you have it's called, I think they try to name it as decoupling. So basically the difference between the heart rate corresponding to the pace in a fresh state versus what's happening when you're fatigued. So if your pace drops and your heart rate remains stable, you have decoupling. If you have a the same pace but the heart rate goes up, you still have decoupling. That I can't remember how it's defined, but it's part of the review paper from Munder I've mentioned before. So that may give you some insights, but again, it's not going to tell you the physiological changes. It's just going to tell you, well, the athlete is having a high effort, is slowing down or not. So possibly a bit easier from field testing, but yeah, you'll have quite little insights from a physiological perspective.
Exactly. And with decoupling, there's the problem of the environmental factors that, for example, a lot of athletes are, especially thinking about age group athletes that don't start their season in March necessarily in Abu Dhabi, like the short course elite athletes do, but they might be gearing up to start racing really now in the Northern Hemisphere at the end of May, as we're talking, or June, July. And they might be getting fitter and fitter compared to the winter, but as the temperatures get higher and higher outdoors, you might not really see that in the decoupling data, because heart rate, at least, is something that I personally can see in my training data, that my heart rate is definitely higher now than it was in, let's say, February for the equivalent workout, just because the temperature difference is so big. I don't think that means that I'm any less fit. I don't feel like I am. So if you're going to use that method, then you have to really factor in the temperature and make it somewhat standardized again. But moving on to, I guess, the important follow-up, are there things that can be done, interventions that can be done, or just factors we should be aware about regarding how to improve your durability?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of ideas around, and there's not really a proper intervention that has been done so far. We've got a couple of attempts, let's say, to look into how, let's say, strength training, for example, can improve your performance in a fatigue state, or repeated sprint training can improve your performance in a fatigue state, and they're coming from the group of bent runner study in Norway. So I think the first paper with elite athletes, at least, was from runner study in 2011 with elite cyclists. They got 3 hours of cycling at 45% Pmax. Well, basically just like easy-ish riding, and then they had a 5 minutes all-out test, and they measured it before and after 11 weeks of strength training, and they found a 7% improvement in the 5 minutes time trial performance. They then repeated it with cross-country skiers and with female duathletes, with couple of other studies in 2017, I think they've been published, and they said they found similar patterns for which strength training seemed to provide a benefit to the performance performed in a fatigued state. And they measured the oxygen consumption throughout, so we can call it. It's not really running economy, because, of course, it's not running, but basically the oxygen cost or the VO2 of the exercise and how that drifts or how that drifted during the trials. And with the elite cyclist bent runners that found that there was a slight decrease in the drift of oxygen from 0 to 3 hours with the training group compared to the control group. And that's something that we've just finished to do with runners as well here at Loughborough. So we had an intervention, still not published, that we're going to present it at ECSS, a conference that is happening in a month or so. Basically, we've got two groups of 14 well-trained athletes. With well-trained, we mean, I think the 10K performance was about 39 minutes. So quite far from the athletes that we've been talking about now and the athletes that just train regularly. But for research, it's a decent standard level. And we've got them running 90 minutes and then do a time to exhaustion at 95% VO2 max. And measured that before and after 10 weeks of strength training intervention. And we did not find actually an improvement in running economy in a fresh state, but it seems that the drift towards the end didn't happen as much after the intervention with the strength group compared to both pre-intervention and control group. And also time to exhaustion at 95% got roughly 40% better. So that can help with enhancing this fatigue resistance, fatigue development, durability parameter that we've mentioned. Again, it needs to be specific. So we did this protocol because we wanted to inform marathon performance. So the intensity of the 90 minutes was roughly at marathon pace, and that 5 minutes at the end actually slightly faster than marathon pace. And that 5 minutes at the end were basically intended to be like the final kick of the last kilometer or two of the race when you want to push yourself over the finish line, or you have to produce high efforts to win a race. At the moment, you see more and more races where you get three or four athletes that are all the way to 38, 39 kilometers together, and then eventually somebody can lead and win with almost like a sprinting finish, which wasn't the case a few years ago. So that's something that, well, we've been trying, and there's some evidence from other sports. You have evidence of carbohydrate intake as well. So the group of Andy Jones with Ida Clark, Finn Papers, 2018-2019, they've got 2 hours of cycling between GET and critical power, and then they measured critical power in a conditions with carbohydrate feeding and one with placebo. And they found that critical power didn't drop as much with carbohydrate feeding. And, well, that makes sense. Basically, you want to eat carbohydrates to be able to maintain your ability to maintain your physiology similar to a fresh state, which links up to what we said before with the potential effect of carbohydrate with reducing oxygen drift during exercise and just reduce the amount of fat that you're using, which are less efficient. Some other interventions that can be helpful is possibly training volume over the years, or just like consistent exposure to aerobic exercise. There's no intervention for that, but that's basically what we've seen with these papers about comparison between under 23 athletes and World Tour cyclists. So the World Tour cyclists, they've got more time to be exposed to year in, year out, high volume of training. And well, that seems to be logical as well. And if you look into some other sports, it may make sense. So with running, for example, middle distance runners, 800, 1500 meters, they can be very successful even if they're quite young. So 18, 19, 20 years old records, they're not very far from the world records. Whether if you look at the marathon, it happens very rarely that you get a very high-performing athlete being younger than 25, 26 years old. So that may connect to that narrative. And perhaps on triathlon as well, you tend to move to longer distances as you age. And if you look at the arena games, for example, which are very short, you have young athletes that they can compete quite well, but then when they move towards the Olympic distance, they're not ready yet for it.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. You can find the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com, and you can find lots of links, both to related episodes that I've done here before on the podcast, with guests we mentioned, and also papers that we mentioned throughout this interview. I won't list them all, but if for those of you interested, there's a bunch of links to other episodes and to papers that are related to what we discussed here today. Next Monday, we will have part two of this interview, and here is a tiny extract of what you will hear then.
The very, very first thing that Renato does is just targeting the race and then say, okay, we know that we can run at this pace, or we aim to run at this pace based on the time we've got and where is your starting point, and then moving backwards from there. So you got your specific target, and then you got the support from the endurance and speed side. So you got, let's say, 5%, well, speed, specific speed plus minus 5%, and then plus minus 10%, and then plus minus 15%. And that sort of creates a funnel of speeds and intensities that they need to be targeted doing during the training period. You want to start off from the extremes, so from the speed and endurance perspective. When we speak about specific workouts, so you still have the easy aerobic exercise just as a aerobic support and maintenance and just easy training, really. But on the other hand, when you look into the workouts, you've got maybe you start off 20% or 50% slower and faster as targets for your workouts, and then you funnel closer and closer to the race pace as weeks and months move forward.
All right, so that is what you will have on tap for next week, so stay tuned for that. I also have a piece of housekeeping here, and that is just a reminder that I have a few Q&A episodes planned that I will be recording shortly, and I have the following topics. So if you have questions on any of these topics, you can submit multiple questions on multiple topics, then please send them to me via email ideally, and I'll put them in my list. So the topics that I will be doing Q&As on are 1, racing, 2, nutrition, 3, myths and pseudoscience, 4, technology, and 5, testing. I don't know yet which order, but any of these topics, if you have questions, just send them in, please. The more, the merrier. A second piece of housekeeping is that for those of you that have reached out about coaching or training plans, especially if you have reached out through a contact form on scientifictriathlon.com rather than emailing me directly. My email, by the way, is michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and I believe it's in the episode show notes as well. But if you have reached out through a contact form and you haven't received a reply, then it may be because my email gets stuck in spam filters. So in that case, try to email me directly, or better yet, contact me on Instagram or Twitter, because that is just an issue that I've noticed, that not everybody receives my emails. It looks like, I don't know, a mass email address, scientifictriathlon.com. So, in certain cases, I have you may not have received my reply, even though I did reply to you. And in that case, I would advise you to just reach out through another channel, and then we can discuss. So sorry if that has affected you. I promise that I get back to all inquiries, and it's definitely not something that I haven't missed any emails or anything, but it might be a spam filter issue. So just try again, please, and we can get that sorted. All right, so that's it with housekeeping, a bit more than normal for this one. But let's finish off now. Thank our sponsors, Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. And use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, and swim training consistency. Even if you have just 15 minutes at home available, you can get in a time-efficient Senate workout that will help you swim better in the water. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get 20% off your first order on senatesuitcare.com/TTS. thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.